education.
Collins versus Commonwealth, Charles L. Weber, Senior Collins Counsel, Michael T. Judge, Senior Assistant Attorney General,
You may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Charles Weber. I represent Ryan Collins in this matter, and I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Did you say three?
This case.
Did you say three?
Questions. Excuse me?
Did you say three?
3 minutes, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
This case involves a question of whether Officer Rhodes violated Collins' Fourth Amendment rights when he trespassed on the private property and trespassed onto the motorcycle for the purpose of conducting a search without either probable cause or exigent circumstances.
When did the trespass occur?
There were two trespasses. The trespass is when he entered onto the private property itself and proceeded up into the driveway area, which is off of the path to the front door.
So an officer cannot walk up a driveway of a private residence?
The pictures that I would point to, this question is whether or not, I think the gist of the question is whether or not it's in the curtilage of the house.
Well, the curtilage of the house, as you know, is around the house, very close to the privacy of the house, but a driveway is not part of the curtilage as a general.
Well, it is. It's certainly not an open field. But I think there's a question as to whether or not what is the license that is assigned for a police officer to enter onto private property.
Well, the Supreme Court said in Jardines 2013 that walking up a driveway on a private residence is not the same thing as walking into the curtilage.
They assume that the curtilage of the house was the porch, and that you could walk up to the driveway to the porch, but they said even that was a trespass if it was associated with a purpose to conduct a search. The Jardines case specifically...
I don't know of any authority that's extended that as far as you just did. The concept was you had the drug-sniffing dog sniffing inside the house from outside the house within the curtilage. So it was just like Kelo. That was the logic of the opinion. But if you go on to the... If you go up and knock on the front door and you're knocking for the purpose of investigation and you're not... And you're up the driveway and you're up the steps... There's no authority that I'm aware of that says that's a violation of the Fourth Amendment.
Your Honor, let me quote from Jardines, because this issue was really hotly contested in oral argument, and the question was whether the entry into that area, whether purpose mattered. And in that case, the question was whether or not even a dog sniff was a search, because there had been a line of cases that said it hadn't. But in this case, it says, the question before the court is precisely whether the officer's conduct was objectively reasonable. As we have described, that depends upon whether the officers had an implied license to enter the porch, which in turn depends upon the purpose for which they entered. Here, their behavior objectively reveals a purpose to conduct a search, which is not what anyone would think they had a license to do. So even if the officer
could
walk up the driveway, he certainly had no implied license to go up there for the purpose of conducting a search for the motorcycle. And once he got there, the Jones case stands for the proposition that a trespass on the effect itself is a search. And so by removing the tarp, it's a separate trespass. So we have two trespasses here.
So why do you need two? I mean, I don't understand why you're spending all this time when the second one is sufficient.
Well, I think they're both there, but the question was about
it's sort of an esoteric argument when the second one is sufficient to support all the rest of your arguments.
Well, I agree with the court. I think it is
why don't you move in that direction?
So in that regard, I think the question becomes one of exigent circumstances here. I think even the Court of Appeals agreed that probable cause and exigent circumstances are both required. I'd like to point to a few facts that may not be clear from either the argument of the Court of Appeals or the argument presented by the government in this case. sort of cherry-pick some facts, and I'm going to point to some very specific facts, and I think that will rebut everything that they said. First of all, they say that within 30 minutes of his confronting Collins at DMV with the Facebook photos, he arrives at the house and finds it covered, the implication being that Collins came home and covered it for the purpose of concealing it. They said the motorcycle was mobile. It had previously eluded the police and could easily do so again, and that Collins, by virtue of having been confronted by the police at DMV, may have had a motive to do that. Maybe. But they conclude that as a result of that, that the evidence was in imminent danger of destruction. The law, prior to Evans, I'll get to Evans here in a minute, but the law usually says that, first of all, you must show that the defendant knew that the police were there, and that there was some evidence that they were in the process of or getting ready to destroy evidence. That's typically. In the Evans case, it came down to what would a reasonable officer believe at the time? Would a reasonable officer believe that evidence was in imminent danger? In this case, some true facts. Okay, first of all, on at page 18 of the joint appendix, and again at page 182 of the joint appendix, two separate hearings. Officer Rhodes admits that when he gets there and observes the motorcycle, nobody's home. Not Collins, not anybody else. There's nobody home in the residence. He said that he went up, he removed the tarp, he took pictures, he did his investigation, he put the tarp back on, he retreated to a point where he could surveil the area and determine when Collins returned home. Okay.
If this motorcycle had been parked on the public street as opposed to parked on the private driveway, and if there were probable cause, would the automobile exception apply to the motorcycle parked on the side of the road?
No, sir.
Why not?
First of all, it's in a private driveway, but I think...
No, I'm asking, would the automobile exception apply to an automobile or a motorcycle parked on the side of the road where you have probable cause?
It would not apply.
And okay, the Fourth Circuit has held that it applies even when it's in a private driveway, but you're saying it doesn't apply even when it's on a public road. Isn't that exactly what the automobile exception is for?
You know, the automobile exception was created to provide the police with the authority to search in a vehicle that where they had probable cause to believe there was contraband in a vehicle, usually on a highway that's been stopped, and based upon two issues. One is that the vehicle was mobile, and two, that there was probable cause to believe that there was a lower expectation of privacy in there.
So you don't need exigent circumstances for the automobile exception. All you need is probable cause. So if the officer has probable cause to believe that this particular motorcycle was an instrumentality of crime and was evidence of crime, why couldn't he, if it were parked on the side of the road, under the automobile exception, which happens every day with automobiles, do exactly the same thing? And then the next question is, as the Fourth Circuit has held, why can't he do the same thing when it's in a private driveway and not in the curtilage or garage somewhere?
The case that's on point that still was cited by the Court of Appeals is the Coolidge case, Coolidge v. New Hampshire, 430 U.S. 443, 1971. And in that case, the police had known that a vehicle had a role in a crime for some time. They knew that there had been a prior opportunity to destroy evidence. The house was guarded, and at that point the defendant had no access, and they actually got a warrant to search the vehicle from the Attorney General, and the Supreme Court said it violates the Fourth Amendment, that all of those, and they said specifically that the automobile exception doesn't apply under those facts. And so the Court of Appeals, when they addressed the automobile exception, they summarily dismissed it and said, you know, the Coolidge case applies, and more than simply the fact that this mobile is required in order to get authority to enter without a warrant, and that more is the exigent circumstances. So that's why we were focusing so much on the exigent circumstances. But the trial court rejected the automobile exception. The Court of Appeals rejected the automobile exception.
They didn't reject it. They didn't address it because they found extra circumstances, and there's no reason to ask whether or not you need extra circumstances if you have it. It's footnote 4.
The automobile exception doesn't require exigent circumstances, but the automobile exception under the Coolidge case doesn't apply in this case, And so all exigent circumstances are required. That's our argument, that that the Coolidge case stands for the proposition. But when it's sitting there, it just, you need more than just the fact that it's mobile in order to search it or search for it. So our argument is that the automobile exception simply just doesn't apply. But getting back to the exigent circumstances, as I was pointing out, the fact that no one was there, even under the Evans formulation, it said, what would a reasonable officer believe in terms of whether the evidence could be destroyed imminently? If no one's home, no reasonable officer could conclude that there's an emergency exception to the warrant requirement. Equally important, Your Honors, is the fact that there were at least three officers present at that scene at that time. On page 74, Officer Rhodes identifies Officer Litton as being there with him. And on page 167 and 168, Officer McCall said he was there with Officer Rhodes and other officers, plural. So there's at least three officers identified by name as being on the scene at that time: Officer Rhodes, Officer Litton, and Officer McCall. And Rhodes seems to imply that there may have even been a few others. I can't identify them. But the fact that no one's home, that they, even if they have probable cause at this point, no one's home is not in danger of destruction. He's got the time, he's got the resources to get to the magistrate and get a warrant. I cited the McNeely case from the U.S. Supreme Court, a recent case that dealt with the probable cause to get a warrant when you have a warrant for a blood test, when you have a client arrested for DUI, and you know that his BAC is dissipating over time. Clearly, evidence is being destroyed over time by virtue of metabolism. They said he still has to show, the government still has to show, and the officer has to show that he did not have time to get the warrant. So I think that time element here and the resources element here are also at play in this case. I just don't see any exigent circumstances that would require an emergency exception to this. No.
You had wanted to save 3 minutes. You're getting very close.
I'm close to 3 minutes, and I will stop right here, Your Honor, and I will wait for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
All right.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Michael Judge on behalf of the Commonwealth. What the trial court focused on, what the Court of Appeals focused on, and what this court should also focus on, is did this officer have probable cause to believe that if he went up and pulled the tarp off that motorcycle, he was going to find something that would further his investigation of the eluding incidents. Actually, there were two eluding incidents, one on July 4th, one on July 25th. This wasn't just a simple eluding incident. This was a man driving 100 miles an hour down a highway who pulled away from an officer pursuing him at 140 miles an hour. That is a very serious public danger for anybody on the highways. That kind of offense has to be taken very seriously. This officer did. He investigated that case, he developed a defendant as a suspect, and he continued to pursue it. When he heard on September 10th, I think it was, that this man was at the DMV, he went to the DMV, this man was Mirandized, he knew exactly what the police were looking at because he pulled two Facebook photographs off of this man's Facebook account, including one that had the silver Acura. The silver Acura was the actual car at the DMV that this man was trying to register that caused the police communications in the first place. Four different judges of the Commonwealth of Virginia now have looked at this case, and three of them from the Court of Appeals said unquestionably the officer had probable cause to believe that going up and pulling that tarp off was going to help further his investigation. This court has repeatedly noted throughout its history that the VIN number is very important. And matter of fact, the VIN numbers are, in the older cases, they have to open the doors for them. They're now required to be on the dashboard so that they can be seen clearly.
In this case, what is the importance of the VIN number when the offense that he's investigating is eluding?
Because he's trying to identify the driver. You have to start somewhere in an investigation, and the VIN number is going to be tied to the original sale. If you start from the original sale, then you can work upwards. My own personal experiences in fraud investigations, working for the Office of the Attorney General, oftentimes you start with an original billing, and then you work up from the billing, and you find out who the fraud perpetrators are in that circumstance. Criminal investigations often start small and go forward. When you look at the cases that the defendant relies upon, one of the older cases is, I actually found more interesting because I'm sort of a law geek, was the Hayden case. And in the Hayden case, they talked about the differences between instrumentalities and mere evidence. And Hayden pretty much just resolved the fact that mere evidence is something that you can search for. And in many cases in investigations that you will see in the records that come before this court, for instance, you subpoena records from Verizon. You want to identify callers to a certain number. You want to indicate who the contents of certain text communications and things. Well, Verizon doesn't have anything to do with the actual criminal activity. They're a third party, and third parties often get these things. You're looking for mere evidence. You're looking to link up things and allow officers to draw inferences and create probable cause for the issuance of warrants, either search or arrest.
But you would agree, I'm sure, that all of the probable cause in the world doesn't justify a warrantless search without exigent circumstances.
Correct.
But why don't you move to that? Because my colleagues may disagree with me, but I'm convinced there was probable cause. So let's move on. What's the exigent circumstance?
In the Evans case, this court noted that the defendants, being aware that the police were looking for him and the existence of probable cause, was in and of itself enough exigent circumstance to justify the search in that case. That is a case-by-case approach when you look at just exigent circumstances. But as the McNeely case, which the defendant also relies on, clearly indicates, the United States Supreme Court indicated there are two categorical exceptions to the warrant requirement. One is the automobile exception. You do not need exigent circumstances into a search incident to arrest.
On that point, how does Judge Gregory's opinion in the Brookings case factor into our thinking? The Fourth Circuit case.
Well, I mean, it's a...
It's an automobile on a private driveway, and the argument was made that, as was just made, that a plurality opinion of the U.S. Supreme Court for Coolidge said you can't ever do that.
I don't think Coolidge is good law in light of Dyson and LeBron. LeBron is very clear. It's a per curiam opinion from the U.S. Supreme Court that was 7-2, and the seven justices that decided that case allowed for the search of a truck in a driveway under the automobile exception. And the two dissenters in that case didn't disagree with that federal analysis. They disagreed on the fact that it was a federal question because they said the state court ruling that they were reviewing was based on the state constitution, not the federal constitution, and therefore they dissented.
So there are two grounds here for affirming if it were to be affirmed. One is you don't need extra circumstances because of the Brookings analysis, which is this is a... This thing can go pretty fast, pretty quickly. All you have to do is sit on it, fire it up, and in first gear, you're up to 80 miles an hour. So there's your automobile exception. As long as it's not in a garage, or as long as it's simply in the driveway of the private residence. And then the other exception is, as we've been talking about, exigent circumstances.
Again, if you in Tim's... back in the 70s, this court actually provided that as an alternative holding to Tim's was the automobile exception. And in Evans, the court talked about what I think we'll refer to as commonalities. And
well, now, the trial court didn't decide it on the automobile exception, did it?
No,
you would be asking in this regard right for the wrong reason.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, the trial court also didn't enumerate any exigent circumstances.
I don't think it's required to under this.
Not under
case.
The automobile exception, that's right. But it's assuming that that's not an issue, just deal with it directly and separately. What were the exigent circumstances that the trial court focused upon? I can't find it. Now, I can provide it. I can provide it myself. I have some thoughts as to what they might have been. I'm not sure that they were sufficient, but I don't know what the trial court relied on.
I don't think that trial court's required to explicitly make findings on exigent circumstances when I think...
Well, when they're all interrelated and with time, circumstances, etc., it would certainly be a good idea to have some indication of what it was the trial court relied upon to justify a warrantless search.
Well, I think it's a fair inference from the trial court's ruling that the defendant was aware specifically that police were looking for that motorcycle and that house, and that the officer knew that he lied to him. As a matter of fact, the trial court made a specific finding on deceitfulness. The defendant also presented evidence from two witnesses at the suppression hearing. Obviously, there had to be falsity in there because the officer testified he went by what was called the Northfields address, and the motorcycle was never there. The mother testified that it was there the entire month of August, and the girlfriend testified she was frequently there and never saw it. So the officer clearly had deceit and knowledge from the earlier part of the investigation that the defendant was somehow involved in this motorcycle, and the defendant is now specifically aware. The officer arrives at the house within 30 minutes of being at the DMV, and at that point in time, somebody has now covered the motorcycle. So now it's very clear to the officer. They have twice lost this motorcycle, and it's going to be potentially lost again if he does not take action, because if he has to take time to run around and get a warrant, which he's not required to do under the automobile exception, and he's not required to do when there's exigent circumstances. The factors that I think are evident from the record is that this defendant, arguably, like was fair with Conwell, has on two separate occasions sped away from officers and created a public danger. He is a potential danger to the officers if they just sit there, because if he comes out and gets on that motorcycle, as Justice Kelsey noted, he can kick it into gear and be going down the highway pretty quickly, and he clearly doesn't care who the other life or property.
Well, let me ask you, what about the fact that the officer said he thought he wasn't home? I mean, the officer who came up there, he thought nobody's here. Does that play into your analysis at all?
No, because nothing really indicated that he wasn't there. I mean, the officer said, you know, he didn't see be anybody home, but somebody was home because we had the tarp put over top of it. And if you look at the reason,
people put tarps on bikes before they leave their houses too.
I'm sorry.
People put tarps on their motorcycles before they leave. You don't have to come home to put it up there. No. I have a bike. I have a dirt bike. I put a tarp on it, and then I come to work. I do other things, but there's still a tarp on my bike.
But there's no evidence of that. And what we do is we look at there's no evidence as to when the tarp was put on. And
exactly.
We look to the reasonable belief of the officer based on the facts that he observed when we assess his determination that there was exigent circumstances. He had the mobility of the motorcycle, which he testified to. He had the eludings, which he testified to. You had the false testimony, which was there. You had the knowledge that the officers were in fact looking not only for this motorcycle but also for this specific house, which the defendant denied all knowledge of, even though he's there with the silver Acura at the DMV, and the silver Acura is in front of the house in the DMV picture or the Facebook picture.
So how is the defendant deceiving you or lying to you in exigent circumstances? I'm looking over our admittedly non-exhaustive list of 10 from Perez. I don't see the defendant lying to you.
I think it goes to the loss of potential evidence, Your Honor. The defendant knows that they are looking for this motorcycle. They're trying to identify where this house is so they can go to this motorcycle.
Okay, what was the danger to others, including police officers, left to guard the site?
If, with all due respect, if this guy comes out the door and he's wearing the helmet that you can't see through again, and he kicks that motorcycle up, he's automatically putting people's lives in danger.
He's got to take the tarp off to do that, right?
Excuse me?
He's got to take the tarp off to do that, doesn't he?
Yes,
you know what a cop is.
I'm not sure that negates the potential danger.
Would the officer have any, if the guy walks up, says, what are you doing? And he climbs onto that bike, hits one button, fires it up, drops it into first gear, within a second or two, he's gone. What authority would an officer have to pull out his weapon or to do anything to say, I'm sorry, sir, you can't leave? He has no probable cause with respect to this defendant. So there's the risk. If someone just walks out and says, hey, dude, and he pops on his bike and he's gone, and now he's back up to 140 again, and now three other officers are trying to chase him.
Yes. My point was there was a tarp on the bike. But I wasn't doing it very well, I guess.
No, and my point was there was a tarp on the bike. You have to remove a tarp before you can get on a motorcycle and start it. Do you understand that?
No, I understand that.
Oh, okay.
But I don't think that this tarp was going to take an exceptionally long period of time to remove, at least from the photographs.
Counsel, getting back to my question, there's no evidence that an officer was even left to guard the site or that there was any discussion or consideration of having an officer guard the site, was there?
I don't think that's in the record. I know that the officer left.
The answer would be yes. There is no evidence because the record does not indicate that there was any consideration of that. How long would it have taken to get a warrant? This was during the day, right?
Your Honor, with all due respect, if there's an exigent circumstance, the case law is absolutely clear that you don't have to do it.
Counsel, you're very familiar with Evans. I was the dissenter in Evans. Yep. I doubt that I'm going to convince three of my colleagues that they were wrong in Evans and that I was right. But I'm really looking at the exigent circumstances, which is why I'm talking about the list of 10 in Verez. And I don't think there was exigent circumstances, which is why I'm trying to probe to figure out whether or not I'm incorrect about that.
Under the factors in Evans, I think it's very clear that this record does have
looking at Verez. I'm looking at the 10 factors in Verez.
Yes.
And that's why I'm walking through them. And so as I'm trying to probe about whether there are exigent circumstances, the answer I'm looking for is not, well, because there are exigent circumstances, he could do this.
One of the factors in Verez was escape. This man had, on two prior occasions, escaped from the police.
Yes. And, counsel, that's exactly why I asked, where is the evidence that they actually put somebody there for the very short period of time I presume it would have taken to get a warrant? So that he couldn't escape this time.
If I can finish first. The second factor, another factor, is whether there was clear PC, and I think everybody...
Nobody's arguing PC.
Third factor, seriousness of the offense. I think this is one of the most serious potential offenses for any community when they have people who have no respect at all for law enforcement, have no respect for the traffic laws of the Commonwealth of Virginia, and drive at 140 miles an hour.
What was the offense that he was convicted of?
He was convicted of
receiving stolen goods having a value of $200.
They were investigating eluding the police.
Understood. So he was convicted of receiving stolen goods.
Correct.
Okay, go ahead. Let's just I wasn't going to walk through each one of them, but you can
right.
go ahead.
Another factor in Verez, was the defendant aware that the police were looking at him, basically? I think clearly in this record, the defendant is absolutely aware the police know the motorcycle, they know the house, and they have him figured as a suspect because he's been Miranda.
And under these facts, that's inextricably tied to number 8, so let's go there. Whether the officers have strong reason to believe the suspects are actually present in the premises. Okay, he wasn't present in the premises. What strong reason? Wasn't simply a reason or some reason. This court has said strong reason. What was his strong reason?
I'm not sure how I can answer something that's not been addressed in the record.
Well, that's my point.
But
in order to have exigent circumstances, it has to be in the record so that we can determine whether the exigent circumstances
agreed,
were there.
Agreed, Your Honor, but Evans itself said only two of those factors were necessary to establish exigent circumstances. Okay. And the two factors that were evident in Evans...
Remember, you need to humor me because I was the dissenter in Evans.
I understand.
And I'm allowed to ask questions based upon my hope that maybe I'll be more convincing in this one than I was in the last one, even though that's probably not the case. But go ahead. Where's the strong reason?
The guy had previously, based on the only thing I could do is argue for these facts, and this man had twice eluded the police.
What's the strong reason to believe that he was there in the house? There is none. It's not, there's no evidence of that.
He was there in the house later. I mean, the officer said it, you know, there's nobody home.
Having asked and answered my question, I have no further questions.
Your time has expired. Thank you very much.
Mr. Collins would ask the front.
Mr. Weber? Rebuttal?
Your Honor, one of the reasons why I do not want to concede probable cause is precisely because of a lot of the things we just heard. Much has been said about all of the lies and miscommunications by Mr. Collins himself. Little has been said about what this officer has said. Let me point to two facts that he disclosed very early on. Fact number one, at the eluding incident, he had a license plate number, and he associated it with somebody by the name of Eric Jones. When he was asked if he spoke to Eric Jones on July 25th, he said yes. Later on, he said he never spoke to Eric Jones.
May I interrupt you for a second? Three of the Court of Appeals judges said probable cause was unquestionably found to be present. So let me ask you this. In Verez, is that an exhaustive list? Do every single one of those factors have to be present for exigent circumstances, or is it an illustrative list?
No, Your Honor.
The fact that one or two or more may not be present is not dispositive at all, is it?
Probable cause is clearly a flexible
concept. I'm talking about exigent
circumstances. And I agree with the court that my argument against probable cause is probably the weaker of my arguments. Okay.
You've got very little time left. I think we all agree with you. Your probable cause argument is very weak. So how do you win if there is probable cause?
I win because there's no exigent circumstances. There's absolutely no exigent circumstances. And as I pointed out, the facts of the case show that when he went up there and removed the tarp, no one was home. There was no possibility that evidence was going to be even moved, much less destroyed. You have to remember it's got to be an emergency to a point where the evidence is going to be destroyed and no longer available. Even if it was going to be moved, it couldn't be destroyed. They had the house surveilled. They had more than an ample officers and time to go get a warrant. They simply didn't do it. And so I think on exigent circumstances, we win. There just isn't any. It's required. And that's
but how about the automobile exception? Don't you lose on that? I know you think Coolidge, the plurality in Coolidge is sufficient. If we disagree with you, don't you lose?
I'm sorry?
Don't you lose just under the automobile exception?
I don't lose under the automobile exception because the automobile exception doesn't apply to this case under the Coolidge.
Okay, but so we don't agree with you because a number of courts don't agree with that. A number of courts don't agree that Coolidge means what you say it means.
Well, Coolidge hasn't been overturned that I know of.
Well, the Fourth Circuit disagrees with you in an opinion issued by Judge Gregory without dissent that the plurality opinion in Coolidge does not mean what you're suggesting. And, in fact, in that case, the automobile exception was applied to an automobile in a private driveway. That was the holding.
I'm out of time.
Go ahead and answer the question. Is there a question, Penny?
No, you're
not. Right. I have one additional question. You indicate there is absolutely no exigent circumstances. As Justice Kelsey pointed out, and as Verez indicates, probable cause is an exigent circumstance. So, if indeed this court believes that probable cause is present, at least one element of the 10 from the non-exhaustive list is there. How do you prevail if there is one exigent circumstance and, as you allege, no others?
Well, what the courts have said is that you require both probable cause and exigent circumstances. You can define probable cause as an exigent circumstance itself, but it standing alone does not create an exigent circumstance. Probable cause and exigent circumstances. And they've even cited the Robinson case from this court for that very proposition. That you need both. You need the probable cause he cites the plain view issue as, you know, well, he saw the thing in plain view, but even the Robinson case stands for plain view is not enough. You still need exigent circumstances. The exigent circumstances here relate to whether or not that particular piece of property was in imminent danger of being destroyed. And I would argue that the record is devoid of anything to indicate that it was in imminent danger of being destroyed. And as I pointed out, when the officers entered the property and removed the tarp, no one was even home.
All right, your time has expired. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the extra time.
Call the next question.